You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So friends, welcome to this session, which is called Unthinking the West. Empire, colonialism, decolonization, these are words which we're hearing increasingly in both our public and private discourse, and they're words which are calling us, compelling us, as here in the West, to face some uncomfortable truths about our past and present behaviours, even when those have been undertaken in good faith and about their ongoing effects. So interestingly, when we were travelling down from Glasgow in our van, we were talking about this in relation to song and the whole idea of global song. And it's very interesting. It's very complex. We're not thinking about song specifically this morning, but we are thinking about mission. How can our mission theology be reformed by a global perspective? Of course, mission is also a very complicated word, and that's perhaps something we'll be looking into this morning. But this session is thinking about how can a reformation or a reformation, if you want to put it like that, renew our understanding of Christian witness in this current age in which we live, this complicated age we find ourselves in. And can we do this in a way which helps us to avoid the mistakes of the past, even if they were well-intentioned things that we did? And is it something that can free us up for a more courageous, a more imaginative future? So to help us with this, I am really delighted to introduce Dr. Harvey Kwiyami and Peniel Ray Kumar. Harvey's a Malawian theologian and missiologist who's lived and worked in Europe and North America. He leads the African Christianity Program and the Diaspora Center of the Church Missionary Society, and he has a particular interest in African Christianity and theology, but also in releasing the missional potential of Africans and ethnic minority Christians living in the UK. And Peniel is a theologian, the canon theologian for York Minster and Worcester Cathedral, and has a particular interest in mission and interfaith dialogue. And they also have with them a group of other people who I will leave them to introduce. But please give them your respectful listening. There will be an opportunity to ask questions perhaps towards the end. So without more ado, may I hand over to you, Peniel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to see you all here today. The way in which we shaped this conversation was that this would be two mission agencies, the senior Anglican mission agencies, being in a conversation on the future of mission and missional theology. When I mentioned to my wife that USPG and CMS were doing something together, she wondered whether this would be the theological equivalent of two mission agencies walk into a bar and let's see what happens. And always being optimistic about theology, I hope that this session will be something of this. I'm sure my USPG colleagues will not be very, did we not turn it this side? Okay, yeah. It just says, trust me, theology is fun. But when we talk of theology or missional theology as being fun, I think one of the ways in which we look at theology in the face of empires is of laughing down and laughing at empires alongside Jesus. And some of you may be familiar with this cartoon of the Laughing Jesus that was produced in Canada. And in some ways, in a context of death-dealing empire, I think it is the purpose of mission to join the laughing Christ in laughing at and laughing down the empires that are in our midst. I've been introduced. I work for USPG as the Director of Mission and Global Theologian, but we are really happy also alongside Harvey to be joined by Dr. Kathy Ross, who is the pioneer lead for pioneer ministry with CMS. Kathy is also a lecturer at Regent's Park in Oxford, and she's also the canon theologian for Leicester Cathedral. And alongside Kathy, we also have the Reverend Canon Duncan Damo, who is the General Secretary of USPG. And Duncan is also the canon theologian for Portsmouth Cathedral, among many other things. So there are a lot of canons here, and we don't know whether they're all going to fire in the right direction. So, as has been mentioned in the introduction, we live in a context where it is increasingly clear that the question of empire cannot be consigned to what can be called the proverbial dustbin of history. Rather, as the Indian politician Shashi Tharoor has pointed out, he reminds us that in looking to understand the forces that have made us and nearly unmade us, we have to realize that sometimes the best crystal ball is a rearview mirror. In some ways, this is an opportunity for us to look at the past, at what we have left behind as two mission agencies who have been involved in a lot of mission across the Anglican Communion, even as we free ourselves into a future of hope, of hospitality, and also of humility, because in many instances, mission and humility have not gone together. And in that context, theologians like the Sri Lankan theologian Aloysius Pieris have spoken about the unholy alliance of the missionary, the merchant, and the military. But while we focus on the greed of the merchant and the guns of the missionary, what I also want to do it is to have a hopeful conversation today, and also focus amidst the complex entanglements of mission and empire on the aspect of the grace that has always accompanied Christian mission despite the flawed nature of missionaries and mission agencies, and how we rely more on that grace to piece together and reweave our theological mat of mission as we seek to reinforce that in Christ we are co-heirs with Christ, and not that there are no outsiders and insiders in the kingdom of God. And with that, what I want to do is we're going to have a conversation. I'm just going to pose some questions for our panelists. And then we're going to see how the conversation goes on, so that it's not just me speaking or the others just providing input. Mission is conversation. So let me start off by asking people to tell a little bit about their own journeys as people who have been involved in mission organizations. So, and also probably as you speak about where you come from, how are you approaching this question of unthinking the West and mission beyond empire? Why don't we start with you, Kathy?
Thank you, Peniel. Morning, everybody. Very good to be here. Good to see you all. So as you can probably tell, I am originally from Aotearoa, New Zealand, which is where I grew up, and have been working in mission and CMS for most of my adult life with my husband and family. We were mission partners in Congo mainly with New Zealand CMS. But just to locate myself a bit, I was thinking about this question and thinking that growing up in Aotearoa, New Zealand, has always made me aware of another culture because we're a bicultural nation. So we live alongside Māori, the indigenous people. It's an official language. Always been aware of a different way of doing things. So that, I think...
I can't hear you from outside.
Can you hear outside? Okay, yeah, I'll stand up. So I was saying I grew up in Aotearoa, New Zealand, always aware of another culture, the Māori culture, indigenous people. And as some of you may know, that's a big conversation in New Zealand, as we Pākehā, the white people, are the manuhiri, the guests, and the Māori are the tangata whenua, the people of the land. And there's always been a conversation about how we coexist together. So the theory and the rhetoric of that is really good. Sometimes the practice is more challenging. And even though I grew up alongside Māori and we speak some Māori, it's an official language, was very aware of another culture that's very different from Western culture. It's much more a gift-oriented culture, much more a culture of what is mine is yours and what is yours is mine, much more sharing, large extended families. It was really still, I think, the Western culture and the system of Western culture that dominates in Aotearoa New Zealand. And then went to be a mission partner in Rwanda, Uganda, and eventually Congo, and began to realise that actually the system of mission is very much influenced by the heritage and the shadow of empire. And just one little story to illustrate that I have never forgotten. When we're in Uganda, at Uganda Christian University, I was listening to a lecture by one of the Ugandan staff on what the African church can offer the rest of the world in mission. This was not even his main point, but he said in passing, the first missionaries to Uganda, who were CMS missionaries from Britain, so the first missionaries to Uganda saw nothing of beauty or value to take with them back to Britain. And I just felt so sad and ashamed and realised that mission has so often been done on our terms, that we think we're bringing civilization. We're exporting our own culture. We're naive about context. We often don't take the time to listen and learn. Of course, there are many wonderful missionaries, and I saw them and I've lived among them, and I saw the sacrifice and the service and the commitment of many wonderful missionaries. There are also missionaries who export dried macaroni cheese to Congo, who have dryers in Congo, which is a hot country, so really you can dry your washing quite easily. So it's complex. And I also began to see what I've come to think of as hopefully this doesn't offend anybody, but maybe it's good if it does, evangelical superiority complex. We began to see some of that. So I guess over years of working in mission, I've been challenged very personally in some of those ways.
Thank you. Thank you, Cathy. Now we're going to go to Duncan and then come to Harvey. Duncan.
Thank you very much, Peniel. I'll try and speak up, so wave at the back if I'm not coming through. Okay. I came into USPG, 7, nearly 8 years ago, totally left field. So I'm not someone who's grown up in the world of mission, of global mission, but I taught anthropology for a long time in university context. I'm much more of an anthropologist, a kind of social scientist than I'm a theologian. And within that context, high levels of skepticism and high levels of self-reflexivity. And then, to my surprise, I found myself running USPG just a bit and stepping into the shoes of some complex and very difficult history. So in a sense, I want to just reflect a little bit on that institutional role. I am what's called the General Secretary of the United Society Partners in the Gospel, but we were called the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts. And as such, founded in 1701, we were basically the missionary arm of a state church of one of the most extensive empires in the world, caught up in mercantile capitalism right at the very beginning of that, you know, involved, enmeshed, entangled, however way you want to look at it, in that threefold thing of commerce, civilization, and Christianity. And in stepping into this institutional role as the leader of that, I am taking on that history. That's part of what is embodied. When I go places, people look at me and there's the General Secretary of USPG with whatever that means for them, with all that kind of 320 years history. So the business of decolonizing, unthinking, rethinking, reimagining, and all of that, for me, is an existential question for USPG. Absolutely foundational. At the last 7.5 years have been a significant journey. And that journey has not just been intellectual, it's been personal. It's been emotional. the huge privilege of meeting with, listening to, just getting glimpses into the lives of other people, other people's context, other people's lived experiences, what is normal for them, which is very alien for me, has frankly changed who I am as a person. It, you know, quite often I've been pretty emotional, to be honest. And that exercise of trying to have what you might call, I want to say sort of ethnographically grounded empathy. What I mean by that is, rather than that simple response which comes from your own experience, where you just sort of think, oh, no, I found that really moving. I can't imagine what it's like to be in that situation. Having something which is more informed around context and which takes process and structure and history really seriously, I think is part of the process of reflecting. So for me, that's been an extensive journey, but it's also been one where looking at our own organization is completely fundamental. And we had a senior leadership team meeting yesterday, and one of my colleagues started using the word complex. And every time he used the word complex, he laughed because he said, that's Duncan's word. Our history is genuinely very complex. And wrestling with that in relation to the categories that we use in the UK, which are often very binary and very simplistic in all sorts of ways, and really getting to grips with the woundedness, the complexity of the world as it is, and really listening to voices which are not my own and don't share my perspective in a variety of different ways, has been kind of fundamental, I think and hope, for us as an organization. And for me, trying to seek ways of leading that organization. So for me, that reflection of my involvement in that is tied up with a role and some of the kind of projections around that role and how one navigates that.
Thank you, Duncan. Harvey, where do you come into this coin?
Thank you. My journey into this conversation started back in the 1860s. So I've been working on this for a long time. But in 1861, David Livingstone led the university's mission to Central Africa to a place called Magomero in southern Malawi. That's my home, that's where I was born. So I was born into that story. It's a story that has shaped my community since the 1860s. The land that was given to the missionaries in 1861 was bought by David Livingstone's daughter, Agnes, in 1891 to become a colonial farm. So, of course, that means that the epicenter of Christian mission, and Magomero was the first British mission station in Central Africa. So where mission started in Central Africa really becomes the epicenter of colonial life in Malawi, colonial farming, colonial everything. My people are deeply shaped by both the story of the missionaries. My community is very proud that we were the first people to receive the gospel in that part of Africa. But also, they are deeply shaped by the fact that this Livingstone estate, which the Livingstone family ran from 1891, 1892, all the way to 1954. Never really making profit, but because they were the largest colonial landowners, they had power in the country that the government could not really do anything without consulting them. So everything that really happens around Malawi really comes out of this land that was given to the missionaries back in 1861. Now, of course, I'm born into that story. I grew up hearing both stories, and both stories shaped my life quite significantly. I knew that I would be involved in mission at a very young age. And really, from that very young age, the question of how did mission and colonialism work hand in hand, especially among my people, among my ancestors, right? This is a story that touches my own family. My great-grandparents have lived this story. My parents were born on this colonial farm. and lived through the violence that this farm really unleashed on the community. How did this happen? How did we move from mission, David Livingstone, to actually colonialism, David Livingstone's daughter, David Livingstone's grandson, and all that story? And so that question really shapes a great deal of what my life has been, to the extent that yes, of course, I had to write a book about it. So this book, Decolonizing Mission, came out this week. So it's really fresh off the press. I wrestle with the story of my community. It's not just my story, it's the story of my great-grandparents. And I wrestle with what that means, not just for the Malawian community, but also for most of sub-Saharan Africa. As I researched for the book, I became aware that in parts of Africa, in Kenya, for example, there is a saying that says there is no difference between a white farmer, colonial agent, and a missionary. Like in their understanding of the world, and for decades, there would be no difference at all between a missionary and a colonial agent. It's like they are one and the same, they are doing the same thing. And it's that kind of story, that kind of life, that living in it, being born into it, and really, I mean, wrestling with it to the point of writing a book, that gets me to a place where we are today. Thank you.
Thank you, Harvey. I think we have a good understanding of the entry point at which our panelists are coming into our conversation. The question of empires today is not just about geopolitical empires. It is also about what people call the landscapes of the mind. And in many ways, theology is important part of the colonization that continues in a very surrogate manner. Even though colonial empires may have left many contexts, I think theology functions as that surrogate space where colonialism is rehabilitated. So, and that is what I want us to think about and tackle. Because there are still, though theologies have emerged from various different contexts in the world, there is still a certain persistent Eurocentrism that marks our theologies. There have been efforts to be subversive and move beyond this, and that is why the first part of the title for this session was about unthinking the West. Not the thinking of West as being this geographical entity, but this ideological system of thought that is present across the Anglican Communion and is present across globally. So now I want our panelists to reflect on how has this thinking of the empire in terms of the unthinking of the West happened in your own theological work. And we had a good entry point there. There is something that has come out. But there are also, I also want to probe the all three of you about your own theological work that has happened in terms of unthinking the empires that continue to rule theology across. So, and why it is imperative for that work to take place theologically. Shall we start with you, Duncan, and then move on to Harvey, and then come to Kathy this time?
Thank you. I think there are two dimensions, two fundamental dimensions to this. I think the first is, frankly, making space. It's not that the West is irrelevant or that Western theology needs to be completely ditched, but it does mean that people need to, frankly, move up the bench and leave some space for other people so that we've got a much greater variety of voices at the table speaking, and those voices have equal time and power in the space that we create. So a much more open celebration of plurality of voices, which are received equally. So you have what you might call an epistemic equality. Everybody's knowledge systems, everybody's voices, everybody's worldview is part of the feast, the celebration of what we call theology. And for me, that's deeply biblically grounded It's there at the day of Pentecost. Everybody hears the word of God, not because they've suddenly understood Hebrew, Latin, or Greek, the privileged languages. They understand it in their own tongue. And for me, that is in your own idiom, in your own culture, in your own cadence, in your own poetry, in your own in song, in your own dance. You know, it's all of that that needs to come into the table and have space. And that obviously means that people like me, people who look like me, people like many people in this room, have to cede space to others and then shut up, he says, with the microphone in his hand. Shut up in the sense that they have to step back and really listen. And there's a deep listening that is involved there. And that means there is a spirituality to this. There is a change in who we are as persons, in our habits of thinking for those in the West. So I think that's one thing. And then I think the second thing is there has to be a decentering of Western theology and systematic theology as we look at it and we think about it. So again and again, and even quite recently, I've seen collections of books and essays on political theology. And the political theology is entirely framed from the Reformation onwards. It's all about a set of intellectual questions which are really about the last 500 years in Europe. What are the political questions? Well, we're worried about secularism. What does post-secularity mean? All these sorts of questions very intensely being debated within a little circle. Nobody is talking about neocolonialism. They're not talking about the militarization of certain parts of the world. They're not talking about the continued extractivism that is going on, which is a continuity from colonialism. So they're not looking at the ways in which the imperial past shapes the global present. So there's a real myopic view. There's a real kind of European focus. And if I can just add... I hope I'm not going on too much here. Let me just add so one sort of point around this is there's a European fantasy that the way that we do politics, which has tolerance built into it around minorities, comes from something called the Treaty of Westphalia. At the end of the fights between the Catholics and Protestants, we suddenly agreed how to be tolerant of minorities. And that's our kind of foundation of who we are. I think that's fundamentally wrong. I think European nationalism begins in 1492 and it begins in Spain and it begins with the exclusion and pushing out of North African Moors, as they were called, of Jews and of creating a more homogeneous Spanish Christian identity. And I think racial exclusion is actually integral to the DNA of a lot of the thinking within the politics of Europe. And we're not acknowledging that and we don't recognize that, but I think that's fundamentally the case. So I think we need to be much more honest and much more realistic in Europe about the depths of some of the dynamics that go on. And of course, we see it resurgent. We have this notion of enlightenment and progression. That is not true. We see a resurgence, you know, most painfully, you know, most shockingly in the US at the moment with white supremacist ideas being openly pushed and in all sorts of ways. So and we're getting echoes of that across Europe. So we need a much more hard-headed view which critiques the center of European theology whilst at the same time allowing ceding space for a diversity of views on an equal footing. Rather than being tolerated, yes, how lovely, we'll listen to you for a while, and now I'm going to tell you how it really is. Rather than that, it's got to be absolutely, and that requires listening in a deep way, which changes who we are as persons. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Harvey. Thank you.
As an African, I'm painfully aware that African voices in conversations like this are quite difficult to find. And if you find them, many of them will actually sound like they're Westerners. And that's the fruit of the empire. That's the legacy of the empire. That it forces people to think like those who have colonized them. And we live with that today. I live with that in my teaching work. I see my students, my African students, not wanting to cite African scholars in their works because they've been taught that if you cite African scholars, your work will be less respected. Empire, right? I see it in the way even African people engaged in mission talk about mission and evangelism, even in the African context, right? That even if we just talk about the focus on the serving of souls, which is a foreign concept in most African cultures, but that defines a great deal of missionary work going on in the continent by Africans working in Africa, just save souls, as long as you plunder hell and populate heaven, and that's Reinhard Bonnke's book. But as long as you do that, you're ticking the boxes. Again, a great deal of Western thought shaping the way we think about mission. And I see that all over. But the way I have worked with this in my own theological work is really to think about mission as a call for us to subvert the oppressive empires of the world. So I talk about a subversive missiology. I do think that that's what Jesus does in Luke 4 when he says the Spirit of the Lord has anointed me, and he has anointed me to go and serve the poor, the oppressed, those who have been oppressed by the empire. And it's Rome in his context, and there are empires. I mean, when we talk about this, conversations like this, people say, you know, colonialism in Africa ended 60 years ago. And I say, that's not true. The continent is still dealing with the effects of that colonialism, but there is now a neo-colonialism that's mostly economic and has more devastating effects than just the political land grab of European countries. And so, yes, the mission that God has called us upon is really to find ways, especially among the oppressed, the marginalized people, to subvert the pressure, the knee of the empire that sits on the neck of these people. Let me stop there.
Thank you, Abby. Kathy.
Thank you, Duncan and Harvey. So I've been thinking about this through the lens of an article that one of our other colleagues, I work with Harvey on pioneer training at CMS, also with Joseph, he's at the back there videoing on his camera, and Noam and James. And James and I recently wrote an article called Being Pilgrim. It was actually for a book on church, and we were asked to write an article on being pilgrim in the shadow of empire. So we reflected on the Church of England, and we argue that we live with the legacy of the logic of empire, and we explored three temptations. And these three temptations, I think, apply particularly to the Church of England, but also to mission. And the three temptations are, firstly, to protect the institution and to cover up. Secondly, to exercise control from the centre. And thirdly, to homogenize and not to embrace diversity. And I think all those temptations are true of empire and mission. And we see that in mission. Well, let me just tell you about a light bulb moment that I had several years ago when I read a book by African-American theologian Willie James Jennings called After Whiteness. And this light bulb moment, everything fell into place for me about empire and mission. So he was actually writing about theological education and the system of theological education. And behind that system, he says, stands, and I'll read you the quote so I get it right. He says, stands, it's a plantation metaphor, by the way, so it's from the world of enslavement. And he's using that intentionally, he's African American. So behind the system of theological education, which reflects empire and is worked out on mission, stands a white, self-sufficient man, his self-sufficiency defined by possession, control, and mastery. Those three words and that metaphor was like a light bulb moment for me. And by the way, whiteness does not necessarily refer to skin colour, although it can do. It's more about... Whiteness may not refer to skin colour, although it can do. It is more a way of inhabiting the world, a kind of posture. And I think we see that in missions. So the first one of wanting to protect the institution and cover up. People don't want to be challenged in some of the ways that we have engaged in mission in the past, as Harvey's already outlined. For example, going in and exploiting the land, ignoring or overriding indigenous understandings and worldview of the land. I see this in my own country. Land is still the issue in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Extractive economies instead of gift economies. You know, I could go on. I think you know what I mean. Control from the centre. How many conferences have we been to where strategies, money, plans, it's all from the centre? So in our teaching and pioneering and in Harvey's teaching, we like to think about the edges. And we think that's where the exciting things are happening. Look to the edge. That's where good things are going on. And that's where the Spirit of God is at work. And that's where we need to be listening and discerning. And in a way, seeing the agency in the edges and what's going on there. And I could give you so many stories from our pioneers who, working with prison leavers or women on the streets or young people, probably groups that Empire are not interested in. But that is where the Spirit of God is at work. And then finally, empires love to homogenize because they want to make everybody like us. But it's about diversity. And I have learned so much about this from Harvey, as you can imagine. I kind of think of Harvey as a taonga, which is a Māori word for treasure, but it's even more than treasure. It's like a very special treasure, which Harvey is for me. And I have learned so much from simple friendship with Harvey. So diversity, I think, just embracing diversity overcomes and rejects and subverts the posture of whiteness in all its manifestations. So those are some temptations of empire that we have tried to resist.
Thank you, Kathy, for that. All three of the speakers have touched on the question of epistemicide, which is about how we challenge the ways in which we develop cultivation knowledge, know things. And I'm reminded of somebody who very wisely said that diversifying those who are dining on the spoils of the empire does not change the menu. The menu remains the same. And for things to change theologically and in terms of thinking, the menu needs to change. And that has come out very clearly. What I'm going to do now is to invite some questions from the floor, because we've got a little over 20 minutes. I'm sure you've got your questions, and then we'll ask the panelists to respond to them before we tie things down. Are there any questions from the floor? Yep. Yes. Oops. Yeah. One.
Can you repeat the question?
Oh, yes. I can repeat the questions from the recording. I saw a hand there. Okay, yes, that's right.
Thank you so much.
Yes, I heard that, but I'm going to summarize that. And if I'm going to go badly, so please correct me. The question was probably, how does this decolonial thinking that you're thinking of in terms of theology, how can that influence public policy, our government's thinking on various issues relating to where the money goes, how things are done in terms of global affairs? Is that a fair capturing of? Okay, yes.
Who wants to take it? Yep.
Just to give my colleagues a little time to think better thoughts than I will articulate straight off. So let me just make one fundamental point. And that is, I think there is a deep, deep tension between the Christian faith and any form of national interest. And I think you need to be hard-headed and realistic about that. We are a people of exiles, as it were. We have a fundamental relationship with other sisters and brothers, And with others, as it were, on a similar journey, fellow travellers, if I may put it like that. And I think that solidarity is primary. I think national interest is always going to, it's going to be very difficult to make that connection. You can lobby, you can campaign, you can do all the rest of it. But fundamentally, we are doing different sorts of things. So I think the most important thing as Christian, is that we deepen our sense of solidarity. And I mean a kind of deep solidarity, a long distance solidarity, a just solidarity, where we can really build relationships between sisters and brothers. We can advocate, we can campaign, we can make arguments to governments, but at the end of the day, national interests are very difficult to shift. And you're never going to get all you want. You might get some compromises, but most of the time you're going to have to work with enlightened self-interest. If you look at the debates that happened earlier this year on USAID, very few of the defenses of that were it's a good thing to help people. Most of the defenses of that were it would be good for our foreign policy. It's to do with soft power. Enlightened self-interest was employed. And Christians, if they want to advocate things, are going to have to find things which align with national interests. And sometimes you can do that. And I think, frankly, most of the time, you probably can't.
Thank you, Duncan.
I think that's a really difficult question. And I think that the church, whether you mean the Church of England as a state church or just people generally as part of the church and part of faith communities, I don't think we're going to have much impact until we're seen to be on the edge, on the margins, practicing weakness and vulnerability, not interested in power, and practicing what we preach, essentially. And if you look through history, the church has been at its best when it's been on the edge and on the margins. Now, that might not be speaking to governments, but I don't think the government's that interested in it because governments are interested in power. Citizens is a great organisation to try and make difference. I think it's organisations like that, possibly. Because I think the Church of England is a state church. It's so embedded, that's our whole argument in our article, it's embedded in the legacy of empire. It's pretty difficult to challenge and be different until it repents.
Thank you, Cathy. I'm going to turn over here for the next question. This is probably a vantage point where you can use the mic yourself.
Thank you so much. Absolutely fascinating. I've written down loads and loads of questions, and I'm going to ask them one after the other. Is that okay? No, I'm not. Okay, I'm just going to settle on one. Harvey, I think you said that you issue a call to subvert the oppressive empires of the world. Yep.
Yes, I think that's what I see in the
mission.
Gospels.
So how does indigenous missional theology subvert Western imperial missional theology? Shouldn't we be seeing a missional theology developing that completely subverts what is known today as Christian theology arising from the West? And what would that look like?
So that's actually the final chapter of the book. Take every opportunity, right? But the final chapter of the book actually is entitled We Need a New Missiology, which basically says we need to rethink a great deal of what we actually understand to be missiology today. Now, in making that missiology happen, we need to actually listen to, for example, how indigenous Africans would think about mission if they were not informed by Western missiological thought, right? And a very good example is this very simple fact that in a great deal of Western missiological thought and practice, you want to target the individual. It's very individualistic in its approach. That's very foreign to us as Africans. We work with communities. We evangelize communities, right? And so if a missiology comes out of Africa, that's bringing that emphasis, it's something that we need to engage with, something that we need to learn from, and really something that actually has to have space to critique a great deal of Western missiology that's gone on for centuries. Another thing is a great deal of Western missiology is mission happens from the powerful people to marginalized people. When we see what's happening in the Gospels, when Jesus says to the Galileans, Matthew 28, right? He's talking to the Galileans, colonized marginalized as they were, he says to them, go and make disciples in the nations. He does not take them to Rome and give them imperial power and then release them. He sends them as a colonized, marginalized people. Maybe there's something there that the African migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea coming into Europe, most of them are Christians. Maybe there's something there that actually can open our eyes to something that God is doing in the world that really subverts the imperial missiology that has shaped a great deal of our work for the past centuries.
Thank you, Javi. Any other questions? I'm going to take my... the question was about how economic colonization impacts the world, given that now countries like China and India are using the imperial logic for of colonization in the economic sphere. That,
I mean, whoever gives you food decides what you do, right? Whoever gives you money has the right to tell you how to use that money. Now, with that then comes the ideological colonialism that follows, that begins to shape people's thinking in a certain way. And I mean, we can say, we've seen this in Africa, that a colonized mind is a lot more difficult to liberate than somebody who has come over and taken your farm. And it's in those ways that, I mean, I did mention earlier that some of my students don't want to cite Africans because they want to appease, please their Western conversational partners. In that way, you end up with a situation, with a system where, yes, of course, these are African Christians, they're in Africa, but their minds have been colonized. They are thinking as if they are Westerners. The way they talk about mission, the way they read the Bible, they are reading it as if they're Westerners. And a great deal is coming because of economics. They want to do things that please the people who can finance some of their works.
Yep. I think we will take... I'm sorry, we've got limited time. I see two hands there, and then we'll see... May I request the panelists to be quite brief in the comments. Okay, let's take those two questions together, if that is okay. And then we'll have one round where we take the other two, if that is okay. Yes, please. Yeah. What future do you see the organization playing in the next generation into, and should you be working for your own end? Yes, Duncan, why don't I ask you to take the last question, and the question of conversions, if either Kathy or Harvey wants to do. I can also probably chip in on the conversion question.
Great. So thank you. To your question, it's really quite complex in the sense that if you take USPG, I'm taking it out of myself. In the sense that there are many Christians, brothers and sisters in different parts of the world, who would say they are more USPG than you lot are in London. Thanks very much. There are people who call themselves SPG Christian. I've had people say to me, "I'm an SPG Christian, learning to call myself an Anglican." So there's a deep sense of identification with, or they will say, you know, SPG founded that. I am a child of the. This is who I am. Don't you start taking my identity away from me. If you know, I've occasionally said, you know, maybe we should fold up and stop. Excuse me, you have no right to do that because we are part of this. So that deep sense of shared engagement and entanglement is really deep in terms of identity. So I think the fundamental thing is genuinely globalizing in our mindset and making sure that the voices and participation and mutuality and multilateral kind of voices, I think, is the way to try and shape and shift the way that we are, I think is the way I would put it. And I'm looking at ways that we can do that more thoroughly than we have to date.
Conversion. So conversion to what? Well, I'd say conversion to Jesus in your context. Context is everything. So what it looks like for someone to believe in Jesus and practice the faith, a Maori woman in Te Araha, it's going to look very different from Harvey in Liverpool or me in Oxford. So we have to allow people to contextualize, enculturate, understand who Jesus is for them in their context and not get in the way. And sure, we'll all make mistakes, but that's okay. The Holy Spirit and God is bigger than that.
And also the question of conversions in a context like India, where Hindu nationalism is on the rise and where conversions are seen as liberation movements of people who are at the very who are called the outcast communities, that brings a very different understanding of conversions in relation to the mission question. I'm going to go to you and you, please.
Evangelism as a concept is spreading the word of God, is making people know Jesus, and historically that has been such a fundamental part of colonialism that we have lost religions, we have lost animist religions, we have lost ancestral religions, we have lost indigenous religions, key parts of indigenous cultures, because of the mission ideal of spreading the word of Jesus. How do you decolonize from that without, like, separating Christianity from evangelism, from the idea that Christianity needs to be known in an age where it is so connected with Western power that it is known, that it is spread? Like, where do we go from it now when we're not a religion that's starting out 2,000 years ago? We're the most populous religion in the world, and, like, one of the most, and like possibly the most powerful. Does not evangelism become like a key part of colonialism within that?
Thank you for that. Yes, who wants to take that question? Shall we? We also take it alongside the other question so that. How do we build, bring culture change in the midst of dissenting powerful voices within churches? Yes. Yep. Good. And I think we heard the other question.
I'll take the evangelism one first. Actually, I'll take the evangelism one. Maybe somebody can take this one. I'm committed to the fact that we share the good news of Jesus. Where I have problems with this whole story is that as it has happened in the past 500 years or so, that sharing of the good news of Jesus has been actually mostly about sharing the good news of Western empires. That has then meant that people who say we want to follow Jesus, they have been made to begin to live like they are Westerners. Forget your culture, forget everything. The true marks of somebody who is following Jesus is in Africa, you drop your African name, you pick up a European name, you forget your language, all these things. Those two things are not necessarily the same. Like, it's the sharing of the good news of Jesus and the sharing of the good news of the empire are two different things. And maybe I think where we should be going forward from now is really focusing about the good news of Jesus that allows people to follow Christ in ways that make sense in their cultures. Stopping forever this spreading of Western cultures around the world as if they are Christianity. Once we get there, then we can make it possible for Nigerian Anglicans to be Nigerian, right? And if Nigerian Anglicanism looks like English Anglicanism, we are in trouble, right? And so we need to get to a place where Ugandan Anglicans can be Ugandan and be Anglican and be able to share the good news with their people in ways that make sense to their cultures.
Resistance from the powerful
within. So was your question about diversity or just... So how in practical ways do we embrace and encourage diversity without World War III in the church? Okay, so I mean it's a good question and it's a hard question because it's absolutely on the ground and where the rubber hits the road. So, I mean, I don't have any magic answers, but things like listening, friendships, what do people in the community actually want? maybe reading books from different cultures and contexts, exposing people to different ways of doing things. I don't know. Do you guys have any more suggestions?
Thanks, Kathy. I've got two. One is actually sometimes conflict. It is just conflict. And you have to just say, this is how it is. I'm really sorry you disagree. We've talked about it a lot. You're in a different place, but, you know, this is where we are. And so sometimes you can't get there. I think somehow tapping into what the underlying fears and anxieties are of people, and that requires some sort of safe space, some safe conversation. Say, what's really going on for you here? What's this really about? I think if you can get to that place, but that's not easy. I fully appreciate that. It takes time, effort, and commitment. So I think it is challenging, but sometimes there is just conflict, and that's just how it is. I just wonder if I could jump back on the first one. If you look at Jesus's ministry, it is all about the dignity, agency, and autonomy. In all of those encounters with people on the margins, it's their agency, their autonomy, their dignity that he is engaged with. And I think, at least when we think about mission, I think we reframe mission. I used the word solidarity earlier. And I think it's about finding ways to be alongside those on the margins in ways which enhance or allow space for their dignity, their agency, their autonomy. I've always been deeply, deeply uncomfortable with the sense of evangelism, which has a power dynamic to it. That just seems to be fundamentally wrong. I think we're all on that space here. But there is this place of coming into a room and just finding ways of sharing which embody an equity and an openness. And I have seen that in places. I'm a hugely skeptical person, but I have seen that in places. And I think we can do that. But I think we start by solidarity with those who are in positions which are more precarious and more fragile. But doing that in a way that doesn't take away their agency. They've still got agency. They've still got a voice. But you can still be alongside that fragility. And I think the other bit about that, and this comes back to Kathy's point from Willie James Jenkins, is breaking down the getting to the vulnerability of those who have power, actually. So those who have power opening out a bit and saying actually what's going on for them in that, you know, often it's quite brittle, and opening that out so that we have a shared humanity, a shared vulnerability, I think is part of what that might be about.
Thank you, Duncan. Sorry.
Can I say one more thing to the lady down here who was asking about your church? And this should have been my first answer, and this is the best answer, and it's something I've learnt from Harvey and Joseph. And I mean, maybe it sounds corny, but it's not. It's prayer. Prayer and patience and listening to the Spirit.
Yeah, and Harvey, do you want to say something? No.
Okay, friends, we really want to thank you. I think what has happened here is that shift to enable us to understand that God's power to transform the world happens always in the most unlikely of places. For example, the cross. And that is the greatest power of transformation. And therefore, the call to be attentive to the margins and the edges around us, and to be open to a new Pentecost, not a Pentecost where we speak with many tongues, but we listen with many ears, a Pentecost of the ears, is what this session has invited us to. And thank you all for joining with us today. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.